Hi, this I'm about to give you a piece called The Last Man Cave. It came about initially because I walked past my local barber's, which is run by a guy called Urs, who will come into it later, and I looked in and I thought, actually, it'd be really interesting to do something in a barbershop. So I wrote this show to do in a barbershop, and I did perform it in a barbershop, which is a weird place to do something in, because actually when you get in there, it's quite small and all the chairs are pointing the wrong way. But, you know, I gave it a go. But, you know, why do something in a barbershop? That's a question. Maybe you'll figure out by the end of this. So anyway, this is called The Last Man Cave. In the beginning, my mum cut my hair. Because they did, didn't they, mums? They cut our hair because they loved us. They had carried us for 9 months. They had battled to give us birth. They had fed, clothed, and nurtured us. And they had kept us safe in a world of uncertainty. And in time, they cut our silky, soft, gorgeous hair with the gentlest snip, snip, snip of a carefully held pair of scissors. Oh, yeah, they loved us. And the besotted way that they cut our hair was a tender, heartfelt, meaning-laden expression of that love. Now, I come here, and Urs cuts my hair. God, there's a whole lifetime of disappointment stumbling between those two facts. I mean, don't get me wrong, me and Urs, we get on. There is a friendship of sorts. But of late, I've begun to wonder about it. Of late, I'm beginning to think that it's not just my hair he cuts. I'm beginning to think that there may be others. I'm beginning to think that he may cut other people's hair. Cheeky bastard. But I'll let it pass this time. Probably won't bring it up when we meet, because when we meet, I tend to be in a somewhat vulnerable position. I'm sitting with my back to him. I've taken off my glasses, so I can't really see anything. And he is holding a selection of implements that could inflict serious violence upon me, should he so choose. I mean, he doesn't so choose. Probably something to do with the barbering code of ethics. You know, point one, don't murder your customers. Think Sweeney Todd was away that day, but he could so choose. The potential is there. Anyway, I'm drifting off the point. But that can happen when you sit in a barber's chair. It does give you time to think. The pause in your day when you can't even check your phone. Time to think. Not always a good thing. So in the beginning, my mum cut my hair. That was the way of the world, the natural order of things, until one day, out of the blue, my mum said, "Oh, you need a haircut. Your dad will take you to the barbers." What the fuck? I mean, honestly, what the actual fuck? Okay, full disclosure, I didn't actually swear back then. I was only a small child. I'm back projecting the swearing to make me seem much more street, much more gangster than I actually was back in the day. Oh, and while we're on the subject of back in the day, I'd just like to point out that back in the day, no one actually said back in the day. The barbers. I was going to the barbers. So here's a question for you. Where was the first place you can remember getting your hair cut? What was your first barbers like? How big did it seem and how small were you? And was it in some strange way? Was it the first place that you went that was unequivocally male? I mean, the first barbers that I went to on that momentous day when my mum had also casually ejected me from a nurturing world of love was around the corner from my house. And it wasn't even a barber's. It was a sells everything hardware store that laid out half its goods on a plastic covered chunk of the pavement. Brillo pads, colanders, mousetraps, and a seemingly infinite array of mysterious household cleaning products. But this was the 1970s, and a seemingly infinite array of mysterious household cleaning products was what we had in terms of unfettered consumer choice. It's what we had instead of Amazon. Yeah, they were simpler times, but we were happy. By the way, unfettered consumer choice means you could get anything except Greek cheese. Inside the actual shop, there was a barber's chair and three stools for waiting customers, all hemmed in by a Parthenon of toilet rolls. The barber was a man called Dave. He was, I guess, about 67. He had a full head of lifeless grey hair, a stiff navy blue nylon jacket, and a fag constantly on the go in his nicotine-stained fingers, and a genteel, faded elegance. Oh, and a light dusting of dandruff on his shoulders that somehow brought out the watery blue of his eyes. He was going to be the first person who cut my hair after my mother. Sometimes in life, you get to grow up very fast, whether you want to or not. At this barber's, there were three haircuts you could get. There was a tidy up, there was the usual, and then there was the hardcore, unclaring blitzkrieg, especially when you're a small, quite timid kid, off a short back and sides. Three haircuts. That was all. But this was the 1970s. That's all we needed. I mean, looking back, I've realised that the seemingly proscriptive micromanagement of the short back and sides left something quite fundamental out. Okay, so the back of the hair was cut short, and the sides of the hair would be cut short, but what about the top of the hair? Why was nothing specified for that? Was the top of the hair the place where the barber could do what he liked, could run amok, could, if the mood seized him, fashion follicle crop circles that only tall people and police helicopters would appreciate when you went out into the world? I mean, I don't know. I don't think it happened to me. But how would I know? I mean, whoever looks at the top of their own head? About a year after that first stepping into that hardware store around the corner, Northcross Road, by the way, the venue for my haircuts changed. I have no idea why, but that's par for the course when you're a kid. A lot of stuff happens that you have no idea why it happens. Like the raisins in the curry of primary school dinners. I mean, raisins? So a year on, I started going to an actual barber shop. And in this barber shop, as well as the three haircuts, there were pictures on the walls of the hairstyles you could have, or allegedly have. Because, to be honest, these pictures were treated with disdain and suspicion. The same disdain and suspicion you would have if you went into a local cafe for a full English and were confronted on the walls by a picture of Eggs Benedict and a champagne glass of Peach Bellini. Yeah, right, like that could happen here. I'm pretty certain that anyone who asked for any of the hair styles on the pictures on the walls would have been looked at askance. And this was South London in the 1970s. No one even knew what the word askance meant. Also, and this is a fairly nuanced legal point, legally, the pictures on the walls of a barber's have to be at least 15 years out of date. Ideally 20, but at least 15. I mean, there are barbers in deepest, darkest South London, probably at this very moment, where should you peruse the walls, you could still get yourself a Tony Curtis, a cut from the 1950s. Now, in retrospect, the pictures on the walls were a useful object lesson in the limitations of advertising, of the gap between what is promised and what is delivered. And this was just one of the things I learned as a small kid going to the barbers. Because the barbers was where you learn stuff you wouldn't learn anywhere else. Man stuff. You would get to hear all sorts of conversations that, for the most part, you didn't understand. But the thing you did understand is that this was what men talked about. And what men mainly talked about was the football. You know how dogs greet each other by smelling the other dog's arse? Well, men talking about the football works in a very similar way. Possible conversational opening gambits include, are you watching the game? Did you watch the game? And he was never offside / completely offside. That bleeding ref needs bleeding glasses. I mean, obviously, there are other ways to kick off the conversation. But these three phrases stand you in good stead in most circumstances. Now, what I learned as a kid from overhearing these conversations was that I not only needed to know about the football, but I needed to support a team. So I went home, picked up the Evening Standard my dad had brought home from work, turned to the back pages and chose the team that were top of the league, Leeds United. I chose Leeds United. I lived in South London. The furthest north I'd ever been in the country was Trafalgar Square on the number 12 bus. The next day I went into my primary school, St Anthony's, top of the road, and declared to my bemused friends that I supported Leeds United. At which point they explained, in no uncertain terms, that this was a stupid idea and why I was an idiot. Obviously, the sensible thing to do would have been to back down and pledge allegiance to a London team. But here I'm afraid my dual heritage kicked in. Big time. Yes, I am of Sri Lankan, Portuguese, Anglo-Indian descent, but I also proudly claim a heritage that is pure South London. In South London in the 1970s, you couldn't back down, ever. So throughout my childhood and adolescence and early adulthood, I, a London-born and bred and buttered, slightly overweight, brown-skinned individual, supported Leeds United, the most hated team in the country, notorious, amongst other things, for their racist fans. So what I'm saying in relation to barbershops is that while I learned a lot of things from the conversations I overheard, I was more than capable of completely screwing up what I learned when I escaped into the outside world. Now, this brings me to the loaded subject of swearing. The barbers was the first place that I heard conversational swearing. Swearing that wasn't aggression-laden abuse hurled in anger, but swearing that was an unremarked upon part of a mundane conversation. And even more revelatory than the conversational nature of the swearing was the fact that it was taking place inside a building. Indoor swearing. Who even knew that was a thing? I certainly didn't. But in the barbershop, that bustling student union of the University of Life, I soon realised that when men talked, it was truly remarkable how often they could get the word fucking into an ordinary, everyday sentence. Or should that be? But I soon fucking realised that when fucking men fucking talked, it was truly fucking remarkable how fucking often they could get the fucking word fucking into a fucking ordinary, fucking everyday, fucking sentence. To put this all into some kind of context, in my home, no one swore ever. But in the barbershop, men swore quite frequently. It was thrilling. And maybe burrowed down deep enough into my psyche, it's one of the reasons that I ended up as a writer, because in that barbershop, I learned that language can be thrilling. The cheap thrill of the illicit, perhaps, but a thrill nonetheless. And back then, we had to take our thrills wherever we could. I mean, we only had three TV channels, and the tank top was an item of high fashion. Times have changed a lot, but in some strange way, the barbershop has stayed exactly the same. Well, for me, anyway. Take, for example, the still troubling dilemma of what to say to the barber. So we've established that the barbershop is the place where men talk. Now, that in itself is a bizarre concept. Men talking, that's not a thing. That's never been a thing, not in the real world. But in the barbershop, men talk. That's just weird. Unpack that phenomenon and you'll find this. When men talk to the barber, other men are listening. We listen as we wait for our turn to get our haircut. And as we listen, amused, confused, riveted, enlightened, enraged, bored, we can't help but be gripped by the low-level panic of the thought, oh my God, when it's my turn, what do I say? Because the inevitable reality of earwigging in on other men's conversations as we wait is that even other men will earwig in on our conversations as they wait. And then those twin pernicious gnawing rats of the male psyche that are competitiveness and insecurity get suddenly clamped in cages to either side of our heads. Competitiveness, insecurity, conversationally, we want to triumph, or at the very least, not look a twat. So what do we say? What level of familiarity do we affect? Now, I've thought about this a lot, and the options break down into two basic types. There are the set plays, and there is what I like to think of as freestyle. I mean, the set plays include the football, of course, but also things like, been on your holiday yet? And isn't this weather awful slash fantastic? And me, I always take the A245. Freestyle, as its name implies, is not for the faint-hearted. It requires a little bit of Eric Cantona turning up his collar after scoring that goal. It demands confidence and determination and a screw-you attitude to the trifling concerns of what other lesser mortals think. Personally, I've never mastered the freestyle conversation in the barbershop. It is one of my greatest regrets in life, that and that thing in 1991 that I really don't want to talk about. So what I'm saying is that the barbers is not only a place where you got to be an audience, it's also a place where you got to be a performer, if you so choose. Of course, you may not so choose. That is perfectly legitimate. No one will judge you harshly. Because the barbershop is a generous enough place to extend its camaraderie to the shy, the inarticulate, the socially awkward, which makes the spinning red pole of the barbershop almost a statue of liberty on the shores of the high street, welcoming huddled masses of men adrift in a fast-changing, bewildering, uncaring world. But for the people who do choose to talk, to perform, to step up to the challenge of freestyle conversation, there is one manifestation of this art that is most aspired to, most revered. I speak, of course, of banter. I know that nowadays banter is sometimes called the bants, but that is just a temporary stupidity that will fade in time, like the career of S Club 7 or the cultural significance of Love Island. Banter is banter is banter. In many ways, the conversational holy grail of man stuff. If talking about the football is the one dog sniffing another dog's arse of male conversation, then banter is the equivalent of the male peacock displaying its feathers. Done well, it is a thing of beauty and a joy, if not forever, then for as long as it lingers in the air and makes us all laugh. Perhaps the greatest pleasure of banter is that, like Twitter or Instagram, it's an open platform. Other people can join in. If they're good enough, if they can keep up, if they can bounce their words off the conversational trampoline that has been built. And within that description, there is a hint of warning, because there is nothing as mortifying, as embarrassing, as cringe-inducingly uncomfortable as witnessing a misguided, technically inept, desperate to please, bantee attempt to join in banter that is way above their banter grade. Yeah, in the barbershop, sometimes it's not only hair that has to be swept off the floor at the end of the day. Sometimes it's also the crystal shards of shattered mailed egos. Banter. It's where attitudes and ideas and words dance. And barbershop banter, done well, may not in any real sense change your world, but it can change your mood. Banter makes things better. And in a barbershop, you can get your hair cut at the same time. It's a win-win situation. But what to say to the barber is not the trickiest dilemma that you will face in the barber's. Oh no, not by a long shot. The trickiest dilemma that you will face in the barber's is to do with who actually gets to cut your hair. Now, this is a problem first highlighted to me by my friend, who, for obvious reasons, shall remain nameless. Peter described the problem to me like this. So you start going to a barber's and you like it. The cut is good. The price is good. The conversation is good. You get on really well with that particular barber. But sometimes he's not the only barber in the barbershop. Now, at that point, my friend, who shall remain nameless, did not need to say another word. I knew exactly what Peter was talking about. I mean, in the world of broken hearts, plenty more fish in the sea is a good thing. But in the world of getting your hair cut the way you like, plenty more barbers in the barbershop is a decidedly bad thing. You see, in a barber's, there is nothing as namby-pamby, as customer-focused, as frankly continental, as an appointment system. In a barber's, it's all done on the TUAW system. TUAW, turn up and wait. Which is all well and good when there's only one barber in the barbershop. But often, that is not the case. Often, there is the barber you like, who you can talk to, who knows how to cut your hair. And there is also the other barber. You know, the one who is hell-bent on destroying civilization and everything and everyone in it, and for some strange reason, has decided to start doing this by fucking up your hair. Even if all you came in for was a tidy up. Okay, I might be overstating the case a bit, but the point is that if there is more than one barber in the barbershop and turn up and wait is how the place runs, then there's always going to be the chance that the guy beckoning you towards their empty chair may not be the one you want. And that's when you have the dilemma. Do you say anything? Do you say, I'll wait for insert name of your favourite barber here? Or do you, hating the situation you're in and secretly despising yourself for your lack of moral courage, do you walk towards the empty barber's chair with whatever the opposite is of a spring in your step? Choose the latter option. And every single second of your haircut, no matter how good it actually turns out to be, will be tinted by resentment. Choose the former option, and while you may well pat yourself on your back for the strength of your character, you will be assailed by the fear that, one, the barber you rejected now hates you, two, the barber you chose now hates you because you've just rejected the person who is his best friend, three, everyone waiting in the barbershop now hates you because you've been egotistical and rude and snubbed the barber who everyone knows has just split up from his wife and now you've rejected him too, you bastard. Oh, and four, you've just wrecked the turn up and wait system. But more than that, you've offered no workable alternative in its place. It's the Brexit vote all over again. Now, so real is this dilemma that I have a friend who shall remain nameless called Peter, who if he turns up at a barber's first thing and sees only the barber he doesn't want, will go for a walk in the hope that his barber turns up soon. I mean, think that through. He's got to the barber's just when it opens so that he can get his hair cut and get on with his day, which is crammed with loads of important things he needs to do. Then he spots the wrong barber and goes for a walk, risking screwing up his carefully worked out timetable for that day. Obviously, I'm much more sensible about these things. I don't go to such extremes, but I will admit to this. In the barbershop of more than one barber, I do become an expert in time and motion studies and complex haircut-based algebraic formula, trend analysis and outcome prediction. I input the number of barbers, the number of waiting customers, the lengths of their hair, the cuts they will probably ask for, and factor in their predicted familiarity with the barber who will cut their hair. From this, as I wait, I can work out whether I will get the barber I want. I am invariably, invariably wrong. I mean, I'm never out by much, but I am invariably, invariably wrong. Because it always comes down to the two barbers finishing their haircuts at about the same time. There will be the barber you want and the barber you don't want. And it will go down to the wire, neck and neck, a photo finish. More often than not, as the end of the haircuts approach, things will start to look okay. Your barber will start to pull away from the other one and will clearly be finishing his cut first. I mean, to be honest, he could stop now. The guy's hair he's cutting looks great, so he could stop now. So you relax, breathe a sigh of relief. All is well with the world. You're going to get the barber you want. Except for some inexplicable reason, like a nightmare you can't escape, your barber, just goes on cutting hair. The haircut is clearly over, but he just goes on cutting hair. And it is at this point that your true nature reveals itself, because this thought will come unbidden into your by now traumatized mind. Oh, for fuck's sake, why are you taking so long to cut his hair? He never had any in the first place. I am not proud of this thought. I mean, can I really be as shallow, as uncaring, and as pettily vindictive as this? Yes, yes, and yes. In this moment, the barbershop transforms itself into a crucible of self-revelation. In this moment, the barbershop teaches us not only truths about the world, but truths about ourselves and what is revealed in the psychological mirror that is metaphorically held up to the back of our heads is not pretty. It's not pretty at all. Well, that's the side of myself no haircut can cover up. Because haircuts, good haircuts, do bizarrely cover stuff up. Like the insecurity, the lack of self-confidence that we as men all have, but that we as men want to conceal both from others and from ourselves. And a haircut, a good haircut, can do that for you. Now, that's probably a good point to wind things up, to brush the hair from our shoulders, possibly offer you something for the weekend, sir, and head for the door. But before we do, let's summarise what we've learned in our time together. I mean, I've called this piece The Last Man Cave, because in essence, that's what a barber shop always was and hopefully always will be. A place where men can spend time in each other's company and both talk and listen. Because one of the downsides of being a man is that often, while we're quite good at talking at people, we're not so good at talking with people. But that's the kind of thing that goes on in a barber shop. And listening is a skill that society as a whole, and men in particular, seem to value less and less. But in the barbershop, men do learn how to listen. So I guess what I'm saying is that the barbershop, the last man cave, is not just a place that acts as a refuge where we can go to hide, because it's also a place we can go to talk, to laugh, to listen, to learn new stuff, to meet new people, and maybe even get a glimpse of a new version of ourselves that isn't just about walking out with hair shorter than when we walked in. And most of this happens because the barbershop is a place where we tell each other stories and listen to the stories other people tell. So you know that question I asked at the start of this about why I was doing a show in a barbershop? Well, I do have an answer, you see. In the beginning, the barbershop was the first theatre I ever went to. Thank you.